And good morning, everyone. So you may be sitting here thinking to yourselves, okay, AI and digital assets, well, what do those have in common? Well, aside from the fact that you can't really have a panel or a conference without talking about AI or digital asset these days, both AI and cryptocurrency obviously have potential to really redefine how our markets operate. They promise great efficiency, speed, but along the same lines, they introduce new risks. So volatility, bias, lack of transparency in certain cases. So our challenge, of course, is to not hamper or slow down innovation, but to make sure that we're innovating responsibly and within regulatory guardrails. So Patty and I will touch on these two topics, and I will start by discussing AI. Specifically, what we're asking our member firms about AI and their use, where we stand with AI, what NFA is doing, some rules to consider, and also give an overview of really what we're seeing our firms and how they're engaged in the use of AI. So our first step, obviously, is to really understand how our member firms are using or considering using AI in their business operations. So for a couple of years now, we have been asking at the start of an exam just some general questions. So it's coming through in the pre-exam questionnaire to try to get a baseline understanding of how our members are using AI in their operations. And when we talk about AI, obviously, you know, you have to define it. And where we're really focused is on the more advanced forms of AI. So we recognize fully that members have been using machine learning and in the, I'll call it, older AI for many years now. So that's not our focus, but our focus is more advanced generative AI, large language models, things of that nature. So we're asking some baseline questions, and based on those answers and responses to the extent that our members are using this more advanced forms of AI, we'll have some more detailed follow-up, especially how, you know, depending upon which area of the operations a firm is using the AI. We've also done some targeted outreach to certain larger members. That was more of an initial step to just really start understanding what firms were thinking about. So some of our focuses. Well, first of all, how is AI being used? Is it being used in an investor or a customer facing manner? Is it being used for, is it anywhere from creating a trading strategy, or is it being used on an internal, more efficiency basis? Is there AI being used for regulatory operations like trade surveillance, monitoring, communication monitoring, things of that nature? We want to understand, too, governance policies and procedures. So are firms standing up committees? Are they creating policies and procedures surrounding the use of AI? How are they monitoring outputs? Things of that nature. And also, along with that, and talking about monitoring training, monitoring the output. So we're really interested to see if there's procedures in place to look at how models are being trained to the extent models are being used, how are firms going about training the models, how are they making sure that the output is reliable, that they understand the output, and essentially that it's doing what it's supposed to do, right? So that's really a lot of where our questioning would come in to the extent a member is using AI. And then, of course, disclosure to the public. So is there promotional material or advertising being done that is either, one, AI-generated, or is it just promoting the firm's use of AI? So those are some areas you can expect us to dig a little deeper into to the extent you are using these more advanced forms of AI. So moving on to what we've seen. So what have we seen from this kind of initial couple of years of discussing this with members? Well, we've seen a lot of interest, which is no surprise to us. So I think members are obviously very keen to understand how AI can be used in their businesses, where they can gain efficiencies from its use. But we've also seen that our members are being very thoughtful and pragmatic about the application. I think they recognize, which is great news to us, that there are a lot of risks that come with implementing AI. So we've seen many firms establishing committees that are across the organization. And we're happy to see that compliance professionals and legal professionals appear to have a seat at the table so they can weigh in on the risks that come along with implementing different types of AI. So that has been very good to see. We've seen policies and procedures being stood up surrounding AI, and we've seen a lot of consideration, too, for open source AI usage versus an internal created and developed AI. And this seems particularly important to members when they're thinking about the kind of data that they're going to be inputting or use. So clearly with open source AI, there's a lot of privacy considerations that firms are thinking about, what kind of access, right, that open source AI will have to confidential information. We have seen maybe more of a shift towards internally developed AI, especially thinking about things like as a first step, chatbots or internal ways to scrape firm data. For example, just employees saying, okay, what are the HR policies surrounding time off, for example, or benefits? So that seems to be a first maybe leg in before going broader that we've been seeing. In addition to these kind of internal efficiencies, but along similar lines, but maybe a little bit more into the regulatory world, we've seen for document review, perhaps due diligence. So I think firms are really seeing that there might be a benefit for doing just due diligence on different third parties, or if you're looking into different investments or trading research, to use AI to kind of flag for maybe an analyst where to look in a massive 200-page document. Of course, you know, we've heard no one's solely relying on the outputs, but just to kind of flag or pinpoint. So it seems like that's a thoughtful first kind of step into firms considering AI's use. With respect to regulatory functions, firms have been leaning towards different vendors that, of course, are offering different AI solutions. So trade surveillance and how AI can be used to maybe pinpoint better problematic or potentially problematic activity, as well as communication monitoring tools with large language models to really better surveil communications. Is an area where firms have been expressing a lot of interest and looking more towards third-party vendors in particular to use that. So that brings us to where do we stand with AI and how do NFA rules apply? Well, our rules are technology agnostic. The principles based, we don't have an AI-specific rule, but we do believe that our current rules can be applied to a firm who's using AI. So some rules to keep in mind, first being NFA Compliance Rule 2.9. So this is our broad-based supervision rule. And a firm has a duty to supervise all aspects of its activities, right? So this would include the use of AI. And there's a couple interpretive notices, too, that we can kind of drill into because I know supervision is a really, really broad topic. So, for example, third-party service providers. And I know the earlier panel touched on third-party service providers. But to the extent that you're using a third party for a regulatory function and it's an AI service provider, again, that initial risk assessment's necessary, ongoing due diligence over that service provider, and again, really making sure that I think what's important here is you understand what they're doing. So how is that service provider coming to their conclusions or that output? And I think that there's great promise there, but there's also complexity when you're working with a service provider who's providing especially a more advanced form of AI to understand how that model or how that AI may be generating the output. So it's not impossible by any means. It's just more complex. You know, you're getting into a more advanced realm. So you might need to do a little extra legwork to work with that vendor to understand how their tool is operating so you can explain it, right? There needs to be an element of explainability there and understanding of how that third party is working and operating. Cybersecurity risk is also something to be considered, too, especially if that third party, again, has access to confidential information or customer information. So just keep that top of mind when you're considering using a vendor for any kind of regulatory activity. Speaking of confidential information, something else just to keep in mind is whether that system and its use of confidential information may cause any privacy considerations. So thinking through those kinds of topics. And also on the supervision front too, and I alluded to this, really ongoing monitoring and making sure, whether this is external AI or in-house developed, of making sure that you have comfort that the system is performing well, it's detecting the activity it's supposed to be detecting, or it's producing the result that is intended. So we would be looking for things like processes in place surrounding how models are trained, and making sure that there's some kind of procedure there to review that output of whatever AI that you're using. And again, that understanding too should be in place of how it works, so you can explain it to us and you're just comfortable that the thing is doing what you intended for it to be done.
The thing. I like that.
Well, it's too. And I think a really useful way that I think about it is an intern. Interns are great. They do great work. But you're not just going to send an intern out into the world to interact with your most important client or produce something that doesn't get a second level of review. So just make sure that it's very useful, but it has that second level of review and monitoring by someone who understands what the end product is supposed to be. And then also I wanted to touch on promotional material. So this is something that we're very tuned into when it comes to AI. NFA compliance rule 229 covers promotional material, and that's regardless of what or who produces it, right? So we talked about finfluencers earlier today, AI produced promotional material. Also, you know, it could be very useful. We have seen a few examples where it does appear that maybe ChatGPT produced some promotional material, and perhaps ChatGPT wasn't up on the nuances of NFA rules. So it might not be aware that we need certain disclaimers, or we require the hypothetical disclaimer that Patty referenced earlier. But the promo rules still apply whether you have AI-produced promotional material or human-produced. So it needs to be balanced, not misleading, factually accurate. So just keep that in mind if you're kind of looking for that extra help of AI-produced promotional material. Still got to have those disclaimers in there. You still need to make sure that discussions of profit and loss are balanced, all that good stuff. And then the other topic that we consider, too, is when we're seeing firms that are promoting their internal use of AI. So sure, it's worth mentioning, but we wouldn't expect a firm to, let's say, overstate their use of AI. If you have an Excel spreadsheet that you've been using, well, you know, probably wouldn't go out and talk about all the great AI and how advanced it is, because that might just be overstating and overselling things. So we would be taking a close look at the firm's promotion of its AI and making sure that, to the extent you're discussing AI and any kind of solicitation or promotional material, you're actually doing those things, and make sure that it aligns with what you're actually doing in practice. And finally, I can touch briefly too on NFA. I know we always get questions about, well, how are you, NFA, looking to use AI in your regulatory operations? Well, we heard about risk models earlier, so we've been using machine learning, which again isn't one of the more advanced forms of AI, but we've been using machine learning for years when we look at members' risks and try to assess exam priorities. So that has been in place for some time now. But as far as more advanced AI, it's something that we're certainly considering. I mean, obviously, we get a lot of data. We get a lot of information. We get annual pool financial statements that contain a lot of information. And so we recognize that there's great opportunity there to potentially use large language models to kind of scrape that data and synthesize it for us. So it's something we're exploring. But I should say we're in very early stages of that. We really will take a very cautious, thoughtful approach to that, because we also recognize all the risks that I just discussed. So it may happen someday, but it's very early on and something that we'll continue to evaluate as we move forward.
So, hi, with regards to AI, there is this you know, kind of problem we've been trying to address for many, many years, you know, picking out quotes from Bloomberg messages, like to be able to organize them in an organized manner, which is always a little bit of a tricky area. Have you seen anyone to develop AI to deal with this successfully?
I know that that is a problem with communications and kind of those false positives, if you will. I mean, I'm not as familiar with specific vendors, of course, where we've seen success, but I'm sure there's some out there that proclaim to be able to do those things. But again, that goes back to can they do what they say they're going to do? So, but I recognize that that is a challenge to try to reduce the noise, and maybe something we'll talk about in our surveillance panel later this afternoon.
Thank you. I was just wondering, to what extent does the NFA think firms should go when they're trying to validate or test third-party AIs? Because they often don't share the code with us.
Sure.
We can ask what it's supposed to do, how it's supposed to operate. We can get them to attest to various things, but we ultimately can't see the code until something happens. So to what extent are we covered from there?
Yeah, no, understood that, yes, you're probably likely not going to get the code from a vendor. But I think just doing that initial understanding, so you understand what's supposed to happen, and then having some kind of check on the back end to make sure what was supposed to happen happening. Do you see any outliers in the activity that, wait, it should have flagged this, thinking trade surveillance, for example, but it didn't. So just some kind of monitoring on the back end, but recognizing you're not really ever going to see the inner workings of the code. But I think that baseline understanding helps to inform what processes you have in place to do monitoring on the tail end.
I want to follow up on my colleague question. Because when it comes to surveillance, no, and the use of AI, the main issue is the explainability of the model, right? So to what extent can we approach this technology, no, without being actually able to challenge the vendor, no, or the provider? Because it's like a kind of black box sometimes, no? So we will not be able to actually explain how the model works, just to test the output sometimes, no, under some assumptions. But to what extent is that something that we can afford, no, in order to being able to benefit from this technology, no? Because it's not like the surveillance. Maybe it's something we can discuss later, no? But now that this is on AI, no, this is something that probably is interesting for us to know what is the approach in general. Thank you.
Right. Sure. No, I mean, I think that is a real risk, right? But there's a risk assessment that has to be done there with a particular vendor, and I do think that to the extent that you understand maybe some of the elements that vendor is considering when flagging things, then you can see. It's hard to see what they didn't flag, right? And that's always going to be a challenge. But I think obviously if you're getting regulatory requests or there's other sources of information, right? Whether it's complaints or any kind of regulatory inquiry into activity that causes you to go back and maybe manually look and say, why wasn't this captured? So I think that's helpful. But I don't think the expectation, again, is to really dive deep into the black box, but it's really to more have that comfort that it's at least doing what you understand it should be doing. But happy to discuss more.
Thanks, Katie. We're going to move on to digital assets, and I'm sure you can jump in and help along the way. But with respect to digital assets, you know, this is an area that continues to grow. Our members, when they first got into it, was just people dabbling a little bit here and there, a lot of derivatives, digital asset derivatives trading happening, but more and more of our firms are moving into spot digital asset trading, doing it for clients, doing it for pools, a lot in our pools. And so we are continuing to gather information, make sure our rules are appropriate for this, make sure our exam processes encompass this and are achieving our exam objectives. So today we'll just kind of go through the current state of digital assets and what we're seeing and what we're expecting from our firms who are trading in digital assets. So first, the current requirements. NFA does have our compliance rule 2-51 that's been effective since May 2023. And this basically became our anti-fraud rule for this investment product. So we've always had one for futures and options and Forex, swaps. So welcome digital assets to the anti-fraud game. So it's modeled after our other anti-fraud rules, and it applies to all of our membership categories who are engaged in digital asset commodities. And that list grows. It started as Bitcoin and Ethereum because there were actual derivatives products on that, and now it is written to be any product that has a derivatives contract attached to it. You'll notice that I don't have on the slide NFA Interpretive Notice 9073, which, if you are in this space, was a interpretive notice that NFA had put out that gave very specific guidance as to what disclosures needed to be in a CTA or CPO disclosure document, and very specific disclosures regarding promotional material that discussed digital assets. Well, as quickly as we put that out, things shifted and it became outdated. And we were finding that we might issue something that updates it at some point in the future, but right now we have actually gotten our board's approval to rescind that interpretive notice. And we're waiting for CFTC to be back at work to before we submit it to get them to accept it. What does that mean? It just means that all the very specific things that were in there, we are not expecting to see. But remember, promotion material rules say that you have to have a fair and balanced presentation of what you're doing. So if you can't omit material information that makes things misleading. So again, depending on how you use digital assets, you may need to be sure that your promotion material accurately reflects that. So we're not saying you have to include ABC through triple Z, but you will have to be sure that it's a balanced and fair presentation. We've recently updated our member questionnaire that each member fills out, and it really is trying to obtain better information about your activities in digital assets. So we split our questions now between digital asset derivatives versus the spot digital asset products. With respect to derivatives, we're talking about futures, options, and options on digital assets, as well as perpetual futures or swaps. When we're talking about spot digital assets, we're talking about the actual coin or token, or other activities such as lending, borrowing, and staking. The questions themselves really are digging into activities by the member firm themselves, so proprietary activities. It's also looking at your client and customer activities, and that includes activities of the pools that are operated by the CPO. We're asking really the who, what, where, and when kind of idea here. So location of where the digital assets are held, so what digital asset exchanges are you using, what custodians do you have, and what platforms. At the pool level, we're also asking the amount of the pool's net asset value that is in digital assets, because we do want to know the materiality. Is your firm just dabbling in it, or is it a significant portion of your pool's activity? When you're dealing with both of these, Katie talked about the cybersecurity risks with respect to AI. Certainly, digital assets has cybersecurity risks as well. And of course, some firms who are dealing with this are very tech-heavy firms. So as a result, we would expect their cybersecurity program to be very robust to include to be tailored to their operations and address all those risks that they have. We've got, you know, due diligence on the exchanges and the custodians that you're using, being sure that you know where your assets are and how they're being held. We've also seen firms who have what my colleagues would call kind of their own ecosystem with respect to digital assets. So, you know, making sure that you can transfer assets within that ecosystem, but that there's many, many additional controls and securities in place when you're trying to transfer assets out of that ecosystem. So just really, you know, kind of making sure that your highest risk areas have the most controls possible, and ring fencing that basically to isolate those risks. You have to think about the information that you are providing to your administrators. There are some administrators that very much are specializing in this space, and they have lots of systems in place, but then there's others who really, maybe it's your long-standing administrator that you've always had, and now you're moving into this space, and they don't have quite the infrastructure and risk and security that you would need for this space. So you have to consider that as well. Access to private keys and public keys. This is an interesting thing. We've unfortunately have run into situations where how it was stored, how the wallets were stored and the pass keys were stored, they thought was a pretty good plan, and then something happened and malfunctioned, and those keys were no longer available, and that meant assets of, and in this case pool assets, were at harm and couldn't be accessed. So definitely think through not only the storage of those pass keys, but what the backup plan is, could there be, if there is some sort of malfunction in that storage. So digital assets, as I said, it's an evolving area in our examinations. We're seeing it more and more, and we do have some people specialized on looking at it and focused on it so that we are making our programs evolve as the industry evolves and our members' use of digital assets evolves. But so as a result, you're going to find that our team of examiners are going to ask you a lot of questions. We want to be sure that you understand, you know, what you're using, and that you can explain to us so that we understand what you're doing. And so who has custody and control of wallets? How are you storing those wallets? What's the access? We're going to ask you to walk through your trading processes a lot with us. You know, just if you're actually making trades every day, great. We can see how it works and you can walk us through that. We want to see that you are able to access your wallets. If you're trading that day, we're going to watch you move things from that wallet to see how it is. We want to be sure that, you know, you own the assets, you have access to the assets, and you can move it, and how it is you go through that process, what controls you have in place, who you're allowing to do that. We are going to take detailed reviews of the wallet activity. We're going to do trade reconstructions, so see how the activity flows into anytime you make a transaction, but also how things are flowing into the financial statements. So at a pool, particularly when, don't just have your admin do it. Make sure that you understand how the gains and losses on a transaction make it into the balance sheet for your activity, the income statement, and then ultimately the balance sheet. For example, we had one firm where they were realizing gains after a transfer between wallets. So it was for the same pool and they were just transferring it between. Well, that's not really how you would do that. That would still be an unrealized gain or loss, right? And so they didn't have the ability to value it as it was going around. They just transferred it and said, gain. Yay. But you do have to be sure that you're paying attention to all of that. The interaction between your firm and the administrator is really a key part of this for pools. And just like I said before, not only if you're dealing with a long-standing admin who doesn't have a lot of experience in this, you might need to find, you know, put in some additional controls over that and make sure you have a lot of firm involvement in it. But even when the admin knows it, you guys need to know it too. So you need to be able to explain to us how things are working and how things are getting accounted. Then there's, of course, promotional material issues with respect to digital assets as well. Two things that I would talk about here is many firms who are are working with digital assets, and this is more you're introducing brokers and FCMs and FDMs, they're not just doing digital assets. They're offering, you know, securities and digital assets and traditional commodity interest products. And when they're putting out promotion material, maybe it's different affiliates that are registered in those different capacities. And maybe they say, you know, ABC Funds is one, and ABC LLC is another. And they're just saying trade all of this through ABC, and people don't really know which firm they're doing business with when they're getting into the different products. So it's important to do that. And in some cases, it's actually a completely third party that you are doing your digital assets trading through. So making sure that promotional material, which is really in these cases their website, is making it clear that if I'm trading digital assets, I'm going through this entity. If I'm trading futures, I'm going through this entity. If it's securities, it's maybe another entity. So just making sure that that's very clear to your customers as to who they're doing business with when they are doing each kind of product. And just kind of some tips, I think, to help you through the exam process. First of all, if you have any flowcharts with respect to how you are doing this, identifying the different wallets, the different exchanges that you're working through, that is extremely helpful to the exam team to be able to know where what the activities is and where they can help identify the various risks that they want to focus on. So the more information you can give them up front on that, the better it is. Like I said, we are going to do trade reconstructions and try to see where a digital asset came from and went to and things like that. And so knowing all of the wallets and seeing those addresses will help with that process. And again, you knowing how digital asset activity flows into the income statement and to the balance sheet rather than just relying on the admin, that is a huge help as well for getting it right and being able to follow it. I think everything we discussed in the first panel is actually also very important. We have found that some of the member firms who are dealing with digital assets are new to our industry, and so they just really don't have an understanding of all the rules and regulations that exist in our industry. So if you are new, definitely pay attention to what we covered in the first panel, because all that stuff about common deficiencies and procedures that you have to have in place applies. And that's probably really the most common deficiencies we have at our digital asset firms. Thankfully, we don't have a lot of situations where the pass keys disappeared and therefore the funds disappeared. That's a very, very unique situation. The more general thing is just general compliance. Any questions for us?
You also mentioned PERPs. They are a relatively recent development in the US, aren't they? And are there any nuances involved? And if yes, can you give some color? By PERPs, I mean perpetuals.
Perpetual futures, if there's, they're relatively new to us, so.
They are relatively new to us, yes. So, I mean, and we have had members that are engaged in perpetual futures or pools that are invested in those. So, you know, something we're watching closely. no specific guidance on perpetual futures, but certainly, you know, all of the rules that we've covered today, I think, still apply with promotional material, etc. So
we've recently completed an NFA exam this summer, and we tried a mix of traditional assets and digital assets. And one of the things that we're really aware of, given the background of the team, is people, hackers coming in, because when you trade digital assets, you're far more of a target for hackers to try and come in and steal those. So we've purposefully tried not to create maps for them to find out where our keys are, who holds the keys, you know, what that looks like if they were to be able to infiltrate into our system and find a document that lays it all out. And I'm wondering how the NFA would view that, rather than having that mapped out specifically, but having that retained in the heads of a few people for that specific purpose of not giving a roadmap to hackers.
Sure, no, and that's understandable. And I don't think we would mandate one way or another. I think we would say, you know, you need to devise what you feel is the best secure way to keep that information, knowing that there's contingency plans, of course, if it's in the head of two individuals, you know, if both, something happens to both or one. So I think it would be really on the firm to assess those and balance those risks, right, of contingency, backup, making sure you have access with the very real cyber threats.
No more questions? Well, thank you, Patty, and thank you, Katie, for a great session.